Welcome to a bonus episode of the Northwest Hospitality Leadership Podcast. Over the last year, Washington Hospitality Association President and CEO Anthony Antone has discussed many of Patrick Lencioni's books on leadership with Chris Jensen of the Table Group. This month, we've put together this overview of each of the books. Check the description to learn about the Table Group and what they can do for you. If you have any questions, you can email us at podcast@wahospitality.org. Thank you to our sponsor, U.S. Bank. Visit wahospitality.org to learn about our purchasing solutions. And now, here's Anthony.
Welcome, everybody, to this month's Northwest Hospitality Leadership Podcast. We have been at this thing for almost 2 years now, or a year and a half. And as this year comes to an end, we thought it'd be great to do a little bit of a highlight to catch you up on what you've missed and really help you understand what you might want to go back and listen to again, or if you're just catching up now, what you might want to go and listen to for the first time. We are committed to this podcast because we know the world is different. And we know that we cannot lead the way that our mentors led, the way that our parents read. You know, and when we grew up, where 80% of the workforce went through the military and used to a military style of leadership. Leadership today is different. 80% of people have not been in the military. They need to be led in a different way, and we need to help lead that type of modern leadership to be successful. The old ways aren't going to work. And so what we're hoping to do is create a conversation about how we in hospitality might lead differently in a new era. We started out with the books from Patrick Lencioni. The Table Group is the team that put all these together. And a member of the Table Group's team, Chris Jensen, has been taking us through the journey as we've gone through 7 of his books. We hope these are great tools for you to pass on to your team and other people you're mentoring to be great leaders, and also for yourself as you've tried to continually improve your leadership. The first clip we're going to listen to today is from the book that started it all, 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. You can't dictate your way through this. You need a great team around you. And the 5 Dysfunctions of a Team really walks you through the elements of creating a great, high-functioning team. Let's hear what Chris has to say about this great book.
Teamwork is not rocket science or complicated, but it is hard work. And the reason why it's becoming increasingly important is at the rate at which things are changing, and you know, the last 2 years have just accentuated this, as things are changing and as information is becoming so accessible, the ability to win on pure intellect or strategy is becoming less and less a competitive advantage. And so one of the reasons why a lot of organizations are looking inward to how well are our people working together is because we, you know, at the Table Group, we say you can no longer outsmart your competitors, because as soon as you think of something, it takes 10 seconds for the internet to find it and for competitors to be able to copy it. And so really our competitive advantage is in how well we actually can work together as a group of people to achieve whatever the objectives of the organization are. The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team is really about the 5 critical behaviors that build high-performing, well-functioning, fulfilling teams. The first behavior is we need to have high trust. The absence of trust is a fundamental dysfunction. And really what we mean by trust is the ability for team members to quickly admit their mistakes, not be defensive at work and around their peers, be able to recognize when somebody they work with is smarter than them and can really have valuable input into their work. So the willingness for team members to be, we use the word vulnerable, which nowadays is a much more common word than it was when the book was written. But that's really what we mean by trust, not reliability, which is what a lot of people think of when they think of trust. That's important too, but we're talking about the ability to be unguarded with each other as a foundation for a really effective team. When we have trust, that enables us to do the second thing, which is be able to engage in effective, productive conflict. The avoidance of conflict leads to teams not dealing with all the information. When people hold back and aren't honest, even when it's uncomfortable, teams and organizations deal with inaccurate or insufficient information. And so when we adopt a mentality that let's, on the basis of high trust relationships, let's be totally candid, even to the point of discomfort, now an organization is dealing with all of the information because now we're not holding back from each other. And so when we do that with humility and respect of our peers, that leads to organizations making better decisions. And we always talk about how conflict with people you trust is about the pursuit of truth, the pursuit of the best idea. And often what people are afraid of is really conflict without trust, which is what turns into competition or politics and positioning, which is definitely unproductive. But conflict with people who have high trust is very productive. And without conflict, we have a hard time doing the third behavior, which is commitment. And commitment isn't necessarily about loyalty to the organization. It's the willingness to let go of disagreement and commit to decisions we make, even if I initially disagree. It's one thing for us to make a decision I agree with. I will really support that. But in a high functioning team, when you as the leader make a decision I initially disagreed with, I need to be willing to let go of disagreement and wholeheartedly commit to that decision and do my part to make sure it succeeds. That's what commitment is about. It's we always steal from the Intel, disagree and commit. And that's an important behavior in the context of team. And commitment and buy-in is important because without it, we can't do the fourth behavior, which is accountability. Accountability is one of the most difficult behaviors in any context. When we work with teams, we talk about peer-to-peer accountability being superior than manager-centric accountability. You need managers to be the ultimate source of accountability. But in a high-performing team, your first point of accountability is peer-to-peer. But we avoid peer-to-peer accountability, one, because it's uncomfortable, and two, because oftentimes I lack clarity that it's an expectation in the organization. And so in a high-performing team, you look at any sport team or any well-functioning team, you will see people are holding one another accountable, not in a punitive way to catch people doing something wrong and throw them under the bus, but out of a desire to help each other be successful. So if I'm doing something that's hurting myself or the team, when you call me out as a desire to help me get better, that's a great team. And of course, accountability is important because it's what enables us to really achieve the collective result we're after. And one of the fundamental dysfunctions in a team that undermines teams is people are more focused on their own status or image or priorities than the collective result of the team. And so that the top of the five dysfunction of a team pyramid is a commitment to focus on the collective good over and above my individual interests. And so the willingness that I have to make sacrifices for the good of the organization or the team is a critical component of teamwork. Now, of course, that requires at the very bottom of the pyramid that we have high trust so that I don't feel like I'm being taken advantage of. And so those five behaviors are critical to a team being effective. The absence of any one of them lead to a team being ineffective and ultimately an organization underperforming. And so this one behavior, teamwork, is a strategic decision that organizations make in order to, one, have a competitive organization, but also in today's environment, have a culture within the organization that's more attractive and desirable to employees. Employees want to be in an environment where they don't have to pretend, they can be honest, and they're desired for the good of the organization. And so when leaders create that environment, it's good for the business and it's great for the employees. People love being in a well-functioning team. That's kind of in a nutshell what's in that book.
The next book is also about employees. And a lot of this is leading our team. And the next clip is about the truth about employee engagement, which is actually written in a restaurant. And it was interesting, this book had really strong recommendations from hospitality leaders across the country. And it's really about how we engage today's team members and today's generations. I hope you look forward to this clip from Chris on his summary of the book.
There are things that every leader and manager can do that has an immediate and real impact on the experience of employees. And one of the crazy things is it's free. It doesn't cost an organization or a leader anything to do these things. And it actually has a real effect on the experience our employees have in the culture of, in your case, the restaurant or the industry. And so it's something we can do right away. And this, what we're talking about today, these are three things that affect the culture in a restaurant or in whatever the hotel or whatever the industry is that you're in related to hospitality. These three things are things you could do right away and it will have a real impact. And it does affect, doesn't matter how much money you make, people will leave their jobs if they feel like any one of these three things are a part of their experience. The first sign that your employees are probably miserable at work is that they're experiencing anonymity. And so as leaders, and what that means is, if our people come to work every day and they don't feel known by their manager and they experience anonymity, they're going to feel miserable at work. And so one of the first things we can do as leaders or managers or operators in our business is help our people feel known. Make sure we know who they are. What are the big rocks in their life? The big challenges they're facing. This is not touchy-feely. This is not about getting into kind of their inner, you know, their inner child issues, but it's just getting to know them as a person. You know, what are their priorities? What's important to them? Who they are? What are their challenges? This is simple. It's not that complicated, but it makes a big difference when people show up to work and feel like the people I work with and the people I work for, they know who I am and they actually take an interest in me. That has a real effect. When people come to work and they believe no one cares that they showed up, they will leave. The second one is equally important, and this is helping your employees overcome the feeling of irrelevance. And this is like back of the house, what does my job have to do with the front of the house? Maybe if I work in the front and I'm interacting with customers and the people, I might have more clear understanding of how my job matters and who I impact. But when employees come to work and they feel like their job doesn't matter that much, there's no relevance to their work, no one cares if they do well, that's going to lead to misery. But if you want your people to come to work and feel like the gifts and talents and my passion, especially I think in the industry, my passion for service or food, if this is having an impact on others, that's going to make a big difference. And so when your employees don't know who their work affects, they're going to be more miserable. But when we as leaders and managers and operators, when we could say, here's why it matters so much for you to do a great job, it goes a long way to have an effect. The last one, if I could jump to the last one,
absolutely,
because this one is probably one of the most difficult, is how do I help my people overcome, and we made up this word, immeasurement. I don't know how to measure my own progress or whether or not I'm doing a good job. The definition of success for me as an employee is totally left up to the subjective opinion of my manager. And so when I don't feel like I'm in control of my own progress and I don't have a way to evaluate whether or not I did a great job at the end of the day, I'm going to leave having more questions about whether I did well than feeling confident that I did a great job at work. And so as leaders, as operators, we need to help our people be clear on how do you know you've succeeded in your job? Whether or not I'm present. And I think we don't do a great job clarifying what success looks like. And so employees are left kind of filling in the gap. Immeasurement, giving people control of how they assess and evaluate their own progress at work. This is key.
The third book we reviewed was The Ideal Team Player. We've talked about existing teams. We've talked about getting engagement from your existing team. But how do you identify that ideal team player that you can bring into your organization and get what you need out of that person? Chris walks us through the summary of that book and how what you should be looking for in finding that ideal team player beyond the core skills of the job itself.
At this moment, the biggest conversation is around finding people and finding the right people, especially when organizations are under pressure, is critical. That's probably been the number one conversation I've been having. And The Ideal Team Player is the book we wrote to answer the question, how do we know in a world where we want people to collaborate, work together more effectively, are there people who are inclined to naturally do that better than others? And for a long time, we didn't actually know. We just assumed everyone can learn to be a team player. And for the most part, I think we believe that's true. But you know, over nearly 30 years of working with executive teams and management teams and leaders all over the world, we realize there are some things that are true, and that's where the genesis of the Ideal Team Player book came out of. The number one question we were getting from leaders was, are there people, now that we understand teamwork, are there people we can look for who are inclined to help us more quickly function like a cohesive team? And the answer is yes. And that's what the ideal team player is. And the quick answer is we need to find people who are humble, hungry, and smart. And as we get it, when we'll get into the details of what those three things mean, but the idea is people need to be humble. They need, in other words, they need to have a very healthy view of themselves. And so we look at humility as not just the absence of ego and arrogance, but also an accurate view of your strengths and what you can bring to the table. So people need to have humility. They need to have hunger, which is about this internal natural ambition and drive to achieve whatever we're looking to achieve as an organization or a restaurant or whatever the organization is. And people need to have smarts, which is the one word in our model that's different than what most people think of when you think of smarts. Most people think of intellectual smarts. But really what we're talking about there is relational smarts. Are people able to be aware of how their behavior affects others? And are they able to actually moderate their behavior in order to work effectively with others? As we've worked with leadership teams over the years, we've realized, you know, there are essentially two types of things you want to look for when you're hiring somebody. People who will reflect the unique attributes of your organization. And so at the table group, we call those core values. But in a collaborative environment, you also want to look for people who are team players. And that's what the Ideal Team Player book is about, is how do you identify team players when you're in the recruiting process? And after you've brought them on board, how do you cultivate those, you know, we call them virtues or attributes in your team members to help build more collaboration across your organization? So that's the like snippet version of that book.
Well, that first set of clips dealt with how we lead our team, our teams, employees, and what we should be looking for beyond just the core skills. This next set of books that we're going to review clips from really deals with our mirror, the thing we hate to look into, or at least I do at times. And it all starts with our motive. What is our motive individually to be a leader? And do we have the right motives to be a great leader? Let's listen into what Chris says about what should motivate us in leadership.
And organizational health is by definition a very leadership-centric way of thinking about running your organization. It requires leaders who are engaged in the business, leading good teams, creating clarity in their organization, and making sure everyone in the organization is really galvanized and rallied around what that organization is trying to achieve. And so the role of the leader is essential. And what the motive is really about is understanding, of all the leaders we've worked with, there's really two types of leaders. Those who are what we call in the book reward-centered leaders. In other words, these are the leaders who are motivated to pursue further leadership opportunities or leadership excellence because of what they get out of it. And so these are leaders who, as they progress in leadership, believe that by nature of their progression, they now have the privilege to be able to opt out of certain responsibilities of leadership. That's one kind of leader. The other kind of leader is what we would call responsibility-centered leaders. These are leaders who are actually motivated to continue to pursue higher levels of leadership and more growth in their leadership because of the responsibility that it carries. They cherish that responsibility. We've worked with many great leaders who are responsibility-centered leaders. In fact, we would probably say all of the great leaders we've worked with, that's their shared characteristic, is they're motivated by the responsibility that comes. The more responsibility you put on them, the more seriously they take it. These two types of motivations affect how a leader leads. And this is really what the book is about. In fact, Pat would go so far as to say, and he said this publicly at every speech he's given related to this book, some people who are in places of leadership and responsibility should probably quit their jobs and their responsibilities if their core motivation is the rewards they get. And the reason for that is because leadership is essentially a servant-hearted responsibility. It is something that affects so many people. And if your core motivation is yourself, the damage you'll affect, not just on the organization you lead, but the people and the lives that you're responsible to lead as well, will be damaging. And so the model is very simple, and it really is meant to put in front of every leader the question, why do you lead? Is it for what you get out of it? Status,
things, material things, whatever it is that you're seeking? Or is it for the responsibility? You feel a tremendous sense of burden to see the organization achieve its intended impact, both on the world and your employees. And that's really what it comes down to. And those who embrace the responsibility of leadership, there are certain things that those leaders can't delegate. And that's kind of what the core of the book is about.
Chris Jensen, man, he does a really great job. Every time I listen to one of his clips, I get more and more excited. We're going to transition from the motive to what we should be obsessive about. What should be driving us each and every day to get better and better? And so the next clips are the four obsessions of an extraordinary executive.
Well, that book is, as you mentioned, it was the second book that Pat wrote. And Patrick Lencioni is the founder of our firm At The Table Group. And that book describes really the core work The Table Group has been doing for the last 25 years. Actually, when Pat founded the firm, there was a clear understanding that what the world of work needed was not more help on what we call the smarts of the business, but on being healthy. And we've talked about this in various ways in different podcasts. But the four obsessions of an extraordinary executive are about describing what are those four fundamental disciplines that really the executives of the organization, especially the head of the organization, the chief executive, which all our books are really written towards that senior leader, what are those obsessions that really they have to pay attention to that they cannot delegate? And really it just boils down to four simple things that are in concept easy to understand, but difficult to put into practice. One, they have to build and maintain a cohesive leadership team. So thinking about themselves as the leader, who are their core people helping them lead the organization they're responsible for? And making sure that team is behaviorally cohesive, high trust, able to be open and honest with each other, even when it's uncomfortable, hold each other accountable. All those things that ultimately became the five dysfunctions of a team book later. The second discipline, actually the remaining three are all related to the second, which is that leadership team has to align around some basic things and ensure there's total clarity for the organization. And we talk about six critical questions that the leadership team must align on, and we'll talk through some of that. The third discipline is once we have alignment and clarity, we have to commit as leaders to over-communicate that. In fact, one of our favorite quotes is people need to be reminded more often than they need to be instructed. That's a quote from Samuel Johnson. And leaders need to do the same thing. Once we understand who we are as a business, what's important to us, our values, our purpose, what our differentiators are for our organization, we have to constantly remind our people over and over again what those are and how well we're doing in achieving them. The fourth obsession is we have to reinforce clarity through human systems. And that just means when we're hiring people, onboarding people, when we do team meetings, when we think of any aspect, when we're rewarding or recognizing people or doing performance reviews, are all of those, we call them human systems, the systems or process that our people have to interact with, do they reinforce the thing that we say we're trying to be, right? Our clarity. And oftentimes a lot of organizations will say we're one thing and there'll be some aspect of their system, whether it's rewards or recognition or compensation, that rewards completely different principles or behaviors or purposes. And so as an organization, we need to look at all of those components to make sure they're actually reinforcing who we say we want to be. The starting point is team cohesion. That's where all things come from. But the real essence of those four disciplines really does boil down to clarity, which is kind of the main thing we want to talk about in this podcast. And it's really at the heart and soul of everything we've done at The Table Group over the years in helping organizations really be successful, no matter what's going on in the environment. And these days, I would say, especially considering everything that's going on in the world and in our region in the Northwest, being clear is probably the most important strategic advantage an organization can have, in addition to having their people behave well together. It's the thing that will create loyalty from customers and clarity for employees on exactly what to do.
The next book about self-reflection and leadership is about five temptations of a CEO. And to try to get everything we can in here today in a 30-minute podcast, we're not going to play you the clip, but I did want to remind you there are things that consistently trap or take CEOs off track from the things they should be doing. So I really hope you like that podcast about really keeping you focused and reminding you don't fall into those traps and those temptations that take you from being an effective CEO to an ineffective one. The last podcast is about working geniuses. And this is the Table Group's latest book, really exciting book, because it identifies the things in the workplace that we love to do and the things that really frustrate us and make us ineffective leaders when we try to do them for long periods of time. And so let's hear Chris's summary of the six types of working genius.
In the framework, we talk about three categories: working genius, a working competency, and a working frustration. And it's not really about strengths and weaknesses. You might have a high level of aptitude in many areas in the working, many of the six areas of the working genius. But a genius means you have this kind of natural enthusiasm and you derive a lot of energy when you're doing certain things. There are certain things that just seem to come natural to us. We get a lot of energy from it. We can do it for a long period of time. The more I do it, the more energized I get. We call that your working genius. And when a team gets to benefit from somebody operating in their working genius, they really get the best out of that particular person, versus a working frustration, which is something that you might have an aptitude for, but you don't naturally derive a lot of energy from it. In fact, the more you do it, probably the more your energy comes down, the more frustrated, hence the name, you might become over time, the more stressed and anxious. And when people on a team have to interact with you operating in a working frustration for a long period of time, they might actually start to feel that frustration, and it starts to bring morale down and the productivity of a team down. The best place to start is going to be the Working Genius Assessment. In fact, this was the first book that we've written where we actually put other resources out before the book. Normally we put out the book first and see what some of the ideas are. But the assessment is what will help each individual leader quickly be able to understand their own working genius. There are six types of working genius. And the first genius is the genius of wonder. And all six of these are required to get anything done at work. And this was to your point earlier about it feels so practical related to work. That's because different than other kind of, there's so many different tools out there to understand how you relate to work. We really tried to, at the Table Group, always focus our content on what's happening in the world of work and how do we say simple common sense things that will help enhance leadership, teamwork, and what we call organizational health, the health of an organization, in order to drive performance. This model is exactly what you were mentioning about the right seat in the bus. That's the exact analogy we use all the time. And the six seats, for lack of a better word, are the genius of wonder, which is, these are the people who have a natural propensity to really ponder and think about opportunities and needs and how things can be different, right? And so in fact, that's how this model came about. Is Amy has the genius of wonder, and she was watching Pat do something in a speech, and she was thinking, why does he do that? And why don't other people do that? And that, we don't often think of that as a genius, but all organizations, companies, projects, teams, everything began because somebody sat and thought about, why is this the way it is and how could it be different? And so from an organizational standpoint, that starts with employees and thinking about the employee experience and what our employees thinking, our customers, our products, our services. All of these things start with somebody has to ponder and think about opportunities that we could go after or we could address. Now, what they need is somebody with the genius of invention, which are people who have this kind of innate ability to come up with ideas, right? Patrick Lencioni, he's got this genius. I mean, he will come up not only with books, but he'll be at his son's lacrosse games coming up with New Jersey logos at the same time. So this is the nature of the genius of invention, is there's this constant desire to, from scratch, really innovate and come up with novel ideas, things that didn't exist before. But not all ideas are equal, which is why people with the genius of invention need people with the genius of discernment, who have a natural ability to evaluate ideas and evaluate opportunities and really be able to discriminate between worthwhile opportunities or ideas and ones that might be a waste of time. The challenge with the genius of discernment is they're usually leveraging intuition or gut instinct. It's not something that's necessarily coming from a spreadsheet or a data. These are people who have a natural ability to discern. And so often you will describe a leader as, gosh, that particular leader seems wise or they have good judgment. That's the genius of discernment in action. And what they need is people who have the genius of galvanizing. People, there's some leaders who have a natural aptitude to get people excited about things and motivate people and create a little initial organization. Some leaders do not have this. They're not energized. They wish they could just say something and everyone would just do it. And so leaders who don't have this, they benefit from leveraging other people in the team who seem to have a natural gift or ability to get people excited and motivated about things. Not every leader has that. Those leaders who have galvanizing, what they need are people who are willing to volunteer and sign up. And that's the genius of enablement. We don't often think of enablement as a genius, but nothing gets done unless somebody is passionate and willing to say, hey, I want to sign up for that. I want to help. I want to do that. If that's something the organization needs, I'm all in. And they have total humility and an eagerness to support. That's a critical component of getting anything done, is the willingness to do some of the work. And so what they offer in terms of effort, what they need is that final genius, which is the genius of tenacity, which is those leaders who are great at saying, okay, now we know we've got something and there's some initial movement. Now let's start putting some milestones and plans and support around this and structure to make sure this gets all the way through to the end and we see the result. So the first thing a person should do if they want to figure out, well, what's my working genius? Well, one, it's so simple, you might be able to recognize it right away. We were talking about this even in the prep call. You know, we were all identifying our working geniuses, but the assessment is such a great starting point because within about 6 minutes, you'll take the assessment, you know, it'll actually just tell you based on the assessment, here's what we think your working genius is. And it'll walk you through a qualitative component if you disagree with it, but that's the best starting point.
Well, I hope you liked our highlight or index episode of this past year of Leadership Podcasts. And I hope you're really understanding the kind of leadership we're going to need in these next few decades is completely different than the leadership we all grew up with. And I hope this inspires you to coach and teach your team on how to help hospitality continue its great run of leadership here in Washington. You can find all these podcasts we just talked about, and in the future, other ones we might add, wherever you can find your podcasts. Just look up the Northwest Hospitality Leadership Podcast and click on episode list. And then scroll down and find which one most interests you and let us know how we're doing. Thanks for everything you do. It's an honor to serve you.
Thanks again to our sponsor, U.S. Bank. Check back here soon for our next season of the Northwest Hospitality Leadership Podcast.